You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in San Javier.
This is a very pleasant spot, Daniel.
We're in the middle of the Sierra de España, which is the one of the big mountain ranges. Well, there aren't many big mountain ranges in Murcia, but it's one of the mountain ranges. Used to be a desert line. These beautiful trees that we're sheltering under now in this on this moonlit terrace, they probably didn't exist about 100 years ago, because apparently there weren't any trees, there was no vegetation here about 120 years ago, and there was a big reforestation program at the end of the 19th century.
Well, this is a real sanctuary, literally, isn't it? Is it an old monastery, this building?
Correct.
It's beautiful, and it really does feel like we're in the middle of nowhere here, and we are at our dinner table, and I feel I'm on the Daniel Freeb hotel list for the first time in this Vuelta, and things have already taken quite a steep turn upwards. How the other half live, eh?
Oh, they will do, Lionel. You know, I hope you pack your swimming trunks, because, you know, you're going to see a lot of swimming pools over the next few days.
Excellent, excellent. We can, we're having a post-stage beer, and we're going to order something to eat, probably, well, ham and cheese. But let's recap stage six of the Vuelta. It went from Herquel Ovara to San Javier, 150.7 kilometres, the first sprint stage of the race, really, with just two third category climbs on the route, three-man break. Richie Porte, the surprise face in that three-man break. Luis Angel Mate of Cofidis, very much not the surprise man in the break. And Jorge Cubero of BH Burgos, they were the three. They never really got too far away. And it was all looking like quite a snoozy stage, really. Mate took the King of the Mountains points on the two climbs. And then it kind of all... Well, I was wondering whether it was going to be the least eventful stage of this season's Grand Tours. But then with around 30 kilometres to go, the peloton got wind of the fact that there might be some wind around the corner as they got closer to the coast. And then on the right-hand turn, there was a pretty nasty crash.
Did you say the peloton got wind of the fact there might be some wind? Is that what you said?
I did say that, yeah. It was kind of a...
You're on flames tonight. You're on sizzle.
Yeah, it was. As the words were coming into my brain, I just said them through my mouth. It's amazing. But yeah, this crash, 26 kilometres to go, it was on a right-hand turn. It was really a blind obstacle for them, because there were these three plastic, blue and white plastic bollards in the middle of the road, a sort of traffic calming measure that really they didn't have any warning of. A few people went down, and from the point of view of the GC, Thibaut Pinot and Wilco Kelderman got caught out. We'll talk about that with Fran Reyes a bit later on. But the stage was won by a man who was creating headlines, fake news headlines yesterday, Nasser Bouhanni, the French rider who seems to go towards, well, he's attracted to trouble, or trouble attracts to him, his magnetic personality. It's his third Vuelta stage win after winning two in 2014. He's also won at the Giro, but it's been quite a long wait for him to win at this level again. But it was a pretty solid win. Beat Danny Van Poppel of Lotto NL Jumbo and Elia Viviani of Quickstep, who had trouble on the run-in round a roundabout and got lost some places and couldn't really recover. But Daniel, this brouhaha with Bouhanni has been brewing over the last 24 hours.
That's another cracking line, the brouhaha involving Bouhanni, the brouhani, brouhahani.
But we'll talk about that in just a moment.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Good luck to everyone riding the Rafa ride from Manchester to London on Sunday. It's a ride for a very good cause, Ambitious About Autism, a charity which helps children and young people with autism. Since 2014, when they started this ride, they've raised more than £1 million for that charity, and the ride has got bigger every year, and around 300 people will set off from Manchester Velodrome at dawn, arriving at London Velodrome in the evening, some later in the evening than others. It's quite a long way, that.
Any stops, Lionel?
Don't start that again. You're making yourself so unpopular with this, and you know, a campaign against cafe stops.
I'm the Nasser Buhani of the podcast.
Well, the man of the moment, Buhani, won the stage. It was a good, clean sprint from Buhani, but there were some headlines in the press this morning alleging all sorts of things, and it turns out that it was fake news. What have we managed to piece together?
Well, Lionel, it was all quite complicated. Yesterday evening, after the stage, there was a report in the Spanish newspaper, AS, the Spanish sports newspaper, that Buhani had been involved in an altercation with his team director sportif, Jean-Luc Jeanron, and he might have hit the team car at a certain point in yesterday's race. Buhani had finished yesterday's stage way off the back in Roquetas de Mar. He'd really struggled. He'd only really just made it inside the time limit, and there were, well, AS reported there had been insults traded with his director sportif, and I suppose this really fitted the narrative that we have been following all year of Buhani not really getting on with his Cofidis director sportif, the management there, and it being a very unhappy marriage. To add to the confusion, or I think the origin of the confusion, was the UCI communique and the commissaire's communique that goes out at the end of every stage. And yesterday it was published in, well, I think at the Vuelta it's being published every day in only two languages, Spanish and French. French traditionally being the language of the UCI. And the chief commissaire is a Canadian gentleman. And as I understand it, the meeting of the commissaires took place in English yesterday, and they talked about sanctions for Buhani and the fact that he had been pushed or been helped along by his team car and director sportif, Jean-Luc Jeanron. Basically, he'd got a sticky bottle. However, this was lost in translation, and when it came out in the communique, what was written literally was that he'd been pushed. There were pushes against a team vehicle. Now, what I think happened was that the eagle-eyed reporter from AS looked at this, put two and two together, thought about the kind of conflict that's been at Cofidis this year, and extrapolated quite wildly that Buhani had been fighting with his director sportif. And you know, I went to Cofidis this morning, went to speak to Buhani, spoke to Jean-Luc Jeanron, and they both talked about an irregular feed, and that is the official, well, that's the terminology for a sticky bottle, isn't it?
It is indeed. Well, Fran Reyes also spoke to Christian Gilberto, one of the other sports directors at Cofidis, about this in the aftermath of Buhani's win this afternoon, and this is what Gilberto said.
For sure, the beginning of the season was not good for him. He was a bit sick, out of shape, like we say, on the difficulties. Yeah, we make the plan to make the Vuelta. And for him, he can build also his shape on a good way. And now, with the result, it's today. And you need to be lucky also for wins a stage and everything. Today was on the good way for him, for the team, Cofidis. Because yesterday nothing happened. It was never fight, never. It was so really a bad day, like we say. And we Jean-Luc, my colleague, tried to help him. He gave a bottle, and the commissaire said a small thing, okay, because it was too long. But he never fight against the car and against the sport director. It's a totally stupid story. And I think the journalists need to do the job in the better way also, and to check before to send like that a notice.
So from Cofidis' point of view, making it clear that the UCI, when issuing these communiques to the media, need to be a bit more precise in their descriptions of events, because basically, as you say, it's been completely lost in translation. Stories were published in newspapers and online that Buhani had been, you know, aggressive towards the team car, which, as Gilberto said there, nothing, that did not happen. But what possibly did happen was that there was an extended sticky bottle. Rick van Slyke, the sports director with Quickstep, if you could see him in the podcast, you would say he is speaking with raised eyebrows here. This is what he said when I asked him about Buhani's win today. Rick, what do you make of that Buhani winning today?
He won the sprint, so he must have been the first over the line. We had a little problem at the last roundabout, which brought Ilya a little bit too far. If it was 3 meters further, okay, then it was a win for us. Now we three meters too short. We came from too far, and yeah, that's the situation. This is sprint. We take our, every time our responsibility. We try to win, but in sprint you win, you lose. Today we lost. It feels very sorry for the guys. They work very hard. The other point, we have also Hendrik Maas in the front, and we at the end we made a good thing, but we didn't win. Okay, it is what it is. We can change.
What about Buhani yesterday, holding on to the team car?
Yeah, but if it was like that, that's up to the judge, up to the jury. We can take him out. We don't gonna blame. This. We saw what we saw. We know what we see. All the teams saw what they saw. And if the jury take the responsibility or not, it's up to them. We can do anything. We just saw that some mechanic was having some assistance to him at uphill. But if his gears don't change, or if it's something technical on his bike, we cannot judge. It's up to the jury to do that. So we'll see. Rumors are what it is, or if anybody has proof, then we can talk. But for the moment, in one way, it's also our problem. But after all, it's not our problem. That's the jury have to decide, and we look to ourselves. We try to win, and if we didn't do the mistake, maybe that question was unnecessary. So we see. We walk on, and we look already to the next race.
So Van Slyke there, if you can listen between the lines, basically saying that it was an extended mechanical service from the Cofidis team car that just so happened to take place on quite a long climb for quite a long time. But as he says, it's not what the riders or the sports directors see, it's what the jury sees. And it's, you know, they dealt with this issue in terms of, you know, dealing with Buhani yesterday. What happened? He got a time penalty?
30 seconds.
So, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty minor misdemeanour. So, not something that you would necessarily use against a rider. But Buhani, he's attracted so much controversy. He's a kind of a lightning rod for all this kind of thing. And it does blow up more when he is concerned, doesn't it? It kind of feels a bit unfair on him, really. But, you know, his the charge sheet, the rap sheet, it's not short, is it?
No, people do assume the worst whenever there is an incident involving him. I think some of it's justified. I think his sprinting style has been dangerous over the years. Some of it is, his attitude at times has seemed arrogant, aloof. But I also think there's an authenticity to him which is quite rare in professional cycling these days. He's a guy with a different sort of background. He's obviously of North African origin, and very much in a tiny minority of riders in the peloton with those roots, and he's had to deal with that throughout his cycling career from when he was a young kid. I mean, he was probably the only rider from that kind of background when he was a young kid, and you know, who knows what effects that could have had. He, to his credit, and whenever he's been asked about racism or discrimination that he's faced, has always played that down and said that's no real excuse for anything. But he's also quite proud of the fact that his father was a bricklayer, I think, and he's proud of, I wrote a piece on him for Pro Cycling Magazine a few months ago, in which, you know, he bemoaned the fact that a lot of other pro riders bemoan, for example, some of the standard of some of the hotel accommodation that they get on Grand Tours. He sort of says, well, you know, when I was a young rider growing up, I was thrilled to be in, for example, a Hotel Campanile when I was away at races, because it was a big adventure for me. And you know, the sort of charm that is palatable to the cycling public and the cycling media does not come naturally to him. And you know, for some guys, it is very much, you know, it's as easy and it comes as easily to them as breathing, really. Someone like Arnaud Demare, his former teammate at Francis de Jure, there was a fascinating narrative where it was Demar versus Buhani there, and the management really had a choice to make who they were gonna go with ultimately, and they went with Demar. And Demar is someone for whom you know, the kind of media savvy, charming sort of butter wouldn't melt attitude comes very easily, and Buhani has to work at it, maybe doesn't work at it hard enough, but what you see is pretty much what you get with him. And I think he has the great virtue of being very different in the current crop of professional riders.
Yeah, let's not forget he's missed the last couple of tours, Tour de France's, because, well, one year he got into an altercation with somebody, a guest at a wedding, on the night before the French National Championships, which is a week before the Tour de France, and, well, not to put too fine a point on it, allegedly he punched somebody.
Biffed him.
Fractured a bone in his hand or in his wrist, and was out of the Tour de France. And as a highly paid rider, that didn't go down well with Cofidis. And perhaps still the hangover of that and a sort of a lack of form meant that, I mean, a baffling decision, really. I mean, Christophe Laporte is a steady rider, but for Cofidis to go with Laporte as a sprinter over Buhani in a Tour de France where, you know, there were several good chances for quick finishers in that first week, I think Cedric Vasseur was making more of a point there. I mean, could he not have accommodated both of them?
Well, I don't think he could in this season, in this particular context, because they had ridden together at what was formerly known as the Route du Sud, and there had been one stage where Buhani was supposed to lead out Laporte. He hadn't done that. He'd won the stage, and they'd had a very visible, that almost was an altercation, or certainly a discussion off the finish line. It was very embarrassing. And by all accounts, Laporte has been the model professional over the past few months. But
he's not as quick. He's just not as quick.
No, he's not as quick, but he didn't do too badly in the Tour de France. I was looking at his results in the Tour the other day, and I think he got 3 fifth places. He's quite a versatile rider, and he's also a young rider. He's a couple of years younger than Buhani. And I think at that stage, early in the season, it looked as though Buhani wasn't going to be at Cofidis next year, although he's got another year on his contract. It looked as though there was going to be a messy divorce. It now seems as though they're going to find some kind of compromise, and he will carry on there. And my big bugbear with Buhani, I suppose, over the last 2 years is that he hasn't progressed as much as an athlete as he should have done. He has been quite disappointing, even when he has had good opportunities, when I think the lead out train was performing pretty well a year or so ago. And you put one side to the fact that there's a whole collection now of former members of his train who have fallen out with him, from Dominique Rolland to Steve Chanel to Geoffroy Soupe, who was a very strong member of his lead out train a few months ago. You put that to one side, I think he has had decently.
You don't want to upset the soup, do you? I mean, it spills and goes everywhere.
No. It feels like we're spitting in the soup right now, just talking about it. But, he hasn't kicked on in the way that I thought he would. And sometimes I wonder whether this kind of move to, or this sort of transition development to become more of a pure sprinter and to build a train, might have penalised him ultimately. Because at the start of his career, he was a very versatile rider who could get over climbs pretty well. More of a sort of puncher almost than a sprinter. And now he's very much a sprinter, so much so that you know, he's struggling to finish stages like the stage yesterday, where I think at the start of his career he would have been very comfortably in the main group.
Well, I think, you know, off the bike he still has the potential to be a puncher, and I think there's room in this welter for a puncher sprinter, not in a literal sense, but I do think it adds a bit of spice to the next couple of days, which may well end up in sprint finishes, because the sprinting field isn't exactly the deepest here, is it? So we kind of need a side story to these next 2 days before the big climb to La Covertia on Sunday. It's been a funny sort of opening few days, and I mean, I think the fact that today's race was so tame, pretty tepid for most of the day, is an indication that it's the heat and the climbing has already started to take its toll here.
Indeed, Lionel. we're in a big area for climbing. The Sierra de Espuña is a big area for climbing. We're also just up the road from the iconic climb, I suppose if you can call it that, of the Vuelta a Murcia, the Collado Bermejo, also often known as the Pantani summit, because Michael Pantani performed very well there a few times in the Vuelta a Murcia.
I was in fact there. That's near here, is it? That was in 1999. He rode the Tour of Murcia, and yeah, and he won there. Rode up through. It's a kind of tree-lined climb, isn't it? It's beautiful.
The Murcian Alpe d'Huez, they call it.
Yeah, I remember. I remember it vividly. In fact, I think it was the second European pro race I ever covered after Het Volk, which was a couple of weeks before that. Yeah, we came down here because the Vuelta a Murcia was on, and the British national team were training, and the Linda McCartney team were training at, where would that have been, near here, near Cal, no, not Calpe, Albia Gardens. Where's that? Have to check. Loads of people will know exactly where that was, but I'm pretty sure we flew in and out of Alicante. Anyway, Daniel, our cheese and ham has arrived.
More importantly, Lionel, the wine list has just arrived. Scott and I, we weren't actually in Murcia last night. We were on the border of Murcia and Andalusia, but we had a Murcian wine. Humilla is the most famous red wine from Murcia, but it was a whopping 15.5%.
Wowzers, wowzers. Well, as Francois Tomaso would say, 15.5 degrees. We've never corrected him.
Our ambition before the end of Vuelta is to order a wine whose alcohol percentage is higher than the steepest section on any Vuelta climb, which is, I think it's going to be about, I think it's about 25%.
We're meandering off course here a bit, but these reds getting stronger and stronger, I don't know whether that's a good thing.
Well, it's not a good thing, because it means that the hole in the ozone layer is getting bigger and bigger, because it's a direct result of it being hotter and hotter.
It is indeed. I mean, people will now be writing in saying that we're, you know, the climate change deniers. I'm sure there aren't many among our listeners, our listeners can be very, very, very vocal about things, as we'll find out in the next part.
This is really going off on a tangent now, but since it's vaguely topical, because he has been in the news recently, Jan Ullrich's mum, for a period when he was a teenager, stopped him from training in the sunshine because she was worried about a hole in the ozone layer. The hole in the ozone layer.
Well, yeah, Jan's quite pale, isn't he, and a bit gingery. You know, that's a problem, you know, I have as well. I mean, you can feel when it's hot down here. I think the most dangerous time is when it's slightly overcast, and then you get back in the car and realise your skin is kind of glowing almost from exposure to. You're too swarthy, aren't you, Daniel?
It doesn't really affect me.
Anyway, well, thank you, Daniel. That's the Daniel Freeb segment of the podcast done. We're now going to travel back in time.
You covered croquetas. You've done the croquetas.
That's coming up next. Sorry. That is coming up next. This is the big controversy of the day, even more controversial than Nasser Bouhanni.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That is Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, reminding me to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast from the Vuelta a España is sponsored by The Economist. You can get a free copy of The Economist delivered to your door if you live in the UK by texting the word cycling to 78070. Now, this morning I was sitting having breakfast looking out at the Mediterranean from my hotel in Roquetas de Mar, knowing that if I look straight ahead, the next bit of land is Algeria, and if I turned slightly to the right and looked across, I was looking in the direction of Morocco. And it reminded me of a story that I read in The Economist earlier this week about the fact that tectonic plate movement means that Europe and Africa are moving ever closer together, apparently at a rate of about 2 centimetres each year. And the story says that eventually the Mediterranean Sea will actually close up and Europe and Africa will join together to form Eurafrica. It's going to take around 50 million years for that to happen. So it's not something that we need to be concerned about just yet. Of course, the closest point between the two continents is at the Strait of Gibraltar, where Spain and Morocco are very close together. But the movement of these plates is going to see the eventual disappearance of the Mediterranean Sea. The Economist says that it is a smart guide to the forces changing your world. And in this particular case, nothing could be truer. The shape of the world is changing, albeit very slowly. But I wonder if in 50 million years' time, whether the Vuelta will have a stage that can ride from, say, Malaga across onto what is currently Morocco. Who knows? Maybe Alejandro Valverde will still be riding then. Who knows? Anyway, if you want to get a copy of The Economist, you can do so by texting the word cycling to 78070.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. As ever, you can get 25% off all Science in Sport products by going to the website scienceinsport.com and entering the discount code SISCP25. That's SISCP for Cycling Podcast 25. On nutrition-related matters, I'm now joined by Fran Reyes, and we're very fortunate that Fran has decided to resume with the Cycling Podcast, because I gather last night, Fran, in the section that Daniel and I recorded, you switched it off in disgust at our talk about croquetas.
Yeah, I mean, for the first time in a lot of years, I didn't listen to the whole podcast, you know? After 5 minutes, I had to stop it in disgust because of the description you gave of croquetas. That was awful. That was ignorant.
Well, you weren't the only one. Okay. So, Gethin Rees emailed us. He lives in Girona, and he said, I just broke off listening to the podcast to write this. It's the closest I've ever come to creating a Twitter or Facebook account to get this message to you. But I thought, I've held out this long. It shouldn't be this issue about croquetas that cracks him and forces him onto social media. So I'm very glad I haven't forced you onto social media, Gethin. He and a couple of people on Twitter, including Liam Burgin, I hope that's right, got in touch to say that croquetas traditionally are made with a bechamel sauce, which is a white sauce with
a bit of cheese and a bit of every different ingredient you can think of. Sometimes potatoes, sometimes usually ham. You know, croquetas, after all, it's a way to give a second life to cooked meals. You know, if you make a thick soup with several ingredients on it, after a couple of days, my mother can make, and most of Spain's mothers can make a bechamel out of the meal in order to produce these fine croquetas to be fried that day or anywhere in the future.
Yes, well, in my defense, when I was in Alorín de la Torre, where I had lunch, the croquetas I had were described on the menu as croquetas de patatas. So they were potato croquettes. And somebody else did back me up, saying that often restaurants, particularly in the south, in the very touristy areas, they cheat a bit and they make their croquetas from potato. But we're very happy to clear up this hugely controversial issue that almost brought the Vuelta to a grinding halt.
Exactly. Just to elaborate a bit more in the art of croqueting, there you can find a wide variety of croquetas in different bars, you know, most of them doing from different parts of the pork, different elaborations of pork meat. There is a saying in Spain, because croquetas are reputed to be one of the most tasty, delightful treats in Spanish food, and there is a saying that goes, you can't be liked by everyone because you are not a croqueta. It's a croqueta that gets liked by everyone.
Yeah, well, they are very popular. They're very Moorish as well, aren't they? You have one and then you immediately want another one. Anyway, so there we are. There'll be some croquetas on the menu tonight. I'm glad to clear that up. Let's get back to the race, Fran. Now, this was always going to be one of those stages where a small break would go, and then we'd watch them going through the countryside for nearly four hours, and then a sprint at the end. But it turned out to be a lot more dramatic than that, because there was this crash around about 25, 26 kilometres to go. It was on a right-hand turn, and there were some bollards, plastic bollards. You see them in a lot of towns, don't you? These plastic bollards in the middle of the road. The first of those bollards was protected with a kind of bright yellow mat, but the riders hit that because they came around the corner. I don't think that there was a man with a flag warning. So it was they were coming blind around the corner, unaware that there was going to be an obstacle in the middle of the road. Somebody hit the mat and that went flying, and a few riders went down. We know Fabio Fellini of Trek went down. From the TV pictures, it looked like Victor Campanets was the worst hurt, because he had quite a big cut on his face, and he finished last, more than 8 minutes down. But the GC picture was affected also, because Wilco Kelderman, who had has had a very good race so far, and Thibaut Pinot, who's been looking well, he's been hiding in the shadows but waiting for the climbs, they both lost 1:44, and that's well, that happens in every Grand Tour, doesn't it? But on a stage like this, where it just got very nervous in those final 30 or so kilometres, didn't it? Did the wind pick up? Was the peloton trying to defend their positions? What do you think was happening?
I think it's just another episode of the long tradition of Vuelta issues with the road furniture. Fair to say also that it doesn't happen only in the Vuelta. Maybe it gets more noticed here just because of the same way that the unusual behavior of Buani gets more spotted than other riders, just because it relates to past episodes. So we tend to have a less forgiving eye on what happens in the Vuelta, in my opinion. I feel that there was a lot of confusion at that point, because everyone knew that 2 kilometers after this right turn, they would be exposed to the wind on the seaside again. And there was a bit of wind blowing, there was a possible chance of echelons, and since there was some chaos in the peloton because of this crash that caught a lot of people, affected some others, sent to the ground a couple of riders like Fellini, who is out of contract and needs a good performance on this Vuelta. It all came down to a head-on fight between the GC teams, you know. And it was nice for there was one guy who could have been affected also by these splits, was Alejandro Valverde. He punctured with around 30 kilometers to go in the city of Cartagena, and he made it back to the group and back to the front of the bunch just in time to avoid the crash.
Well, that's the fine margins, isn't it? I mean, let's hear from Wilco Kelderman, because there were reports that he'd had a puncture, but it wasn't a puncture which was causing him trouble once he got back on his bike.
What happened in the last 20 kilometres? Just talk us through it.
Yeah, we were pretty in front, and it was already really hectic because it was side tailwind. And we went into a village, and there were some plastic rubber poles in the middle, and they crashed just in front of Mike and me. And Mike crashed, and I could brake and could ride again, but they rode full on my back wheel, so my back wheel was really rubbing to my brake. So then I was still there, but they went full, and yeah, I can't push 1,000 watts the whole time, you know. I was really disappointed, and I need to change bikes, and then I lost already a minute or something. So
you happy with the way the team reacted, though?
Yeah, for sure. They really did an awesome job in the end, but yeah. Still lost some time and pretty disappointed.
How will you pick yourself up from this?
Lucky I didn't crash, but I have still good legs, so the Vuelta is not over yet. We'll see the coming days.
Not a puncture, but rear wheel trouble for Wilco Kelderman today. A costly loss for both Kelderman and Pinot. They're the two riders who, you know, were highest placed overall to have lost out. But this issue of the road furniture in Spain, I mean, is it fair to say that the Vuelta is just that little bit below the Giro and certainly the Tour de France in the resources that they have to, you know, mark every junction, mark every obstacle in the road? I mean, it doesn't seem to me like there's quite as much road furniture in the towns. There aren't as many sort of curbs or traffic islands, but those plastic bollards, which are we do see here and there in the towns, they clearly needed more to warn the riders, didn't they, there?
Yeah, especially because they were just out of a turn, and it was not easy to see them for the first rider on the road. Imagine for the 100th one. You know, they were just going in blind. I assume that there is that the bottom line here is that in Spain there is a lot of road furniture, you know, and it has.
So my impression is that in France there is an enormous amount of road furniture. Every town and village has something, and they take quite a lot out before the tour. Whereas here it feels like there isn't quite as much, but I guess they also don't have the budget to remove certain obstacles, you know, before the race comes through.
Exactly. I mean, in France, it also has a lot of road furniture, but I guess the effort made both by the organizers, maybe by the institutions, you know, regions, town halls, whatever, to adapt this circumstance, this road furniture, to the event is huge in France compared to Spain, you know, where the Vuelta, even if it is a top event, maybe it's low-key compared to what the Tour de France represents for the country of France. You know, you can, in order to see how relevant the Vuelta is in Spain, just grab an edition of Marca newspaper. Marca is the biggest red sports newspaper in Spain. Today I read one, and it was 48 pages of a newspaper. 10 of them devoted to Real Madrid and the signing of a substitute for Cristiano Ronaldo, so on and so forth. And for the Vuelta a España, it was only 3 pages. All of them sponsored by Cofidis.
Wow. So Marca won't be criticizing Nasser Bouhanni, will they? Anyway, that's interesting. I mean, it's one of the things with the Giro, when I noticed from having been at the Giro the last 2 years, it always overlaps with the end of the football season there. They're always contesting the Scudetto, probably the second weekend of the Giro, the football's still going on. And the same is true with La Gazzetta dello Sport. It's, you know, football, it requires a lot for the Giro to knock football off the front page even sometimes. Mm. And I guess here, you know, the football season has just started again, and everybody's focus, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona, I mean, they dominate European sport, not just Spanish sport.
Yeah, but it's also a matter of sporting culture. You know, here in Spain, every sports show, every sports coverage is focused on football and doesn't leave that much room to the rest of the sports. From time to time, there is a sport that enjoy the spotlight because there is a very big star. You know, that has happened with basketball, with Pau Gasol. It has happened with Formula One, with Fernando Alonso. It happened with tennis and Rafa Nadal. It happened with cycling and Miguel Indurain. But that's only one lucky sport for some lucky years.
Is this also a little bit the Alberto Contador factor, the fact that Contador is not here and so far hasn't been replaced in the sense of a rider with the swashbuckling style and the anticipation where everyone's looking forward to seeing what he'll do in the mountain stages? Because that was the story of last year, really, wasn't it?
I guess we will find out how much the Contador factor is relevant here in the third week. Because the Contador fever last year, it went up and up, it mounted as the race went on. As for now, I can say that I can recall that the media coverage is the same. There are the same journalists with the same pages, the same journalists with the same space on radio and TV. It's only later that we will see if there is no Spanish rider, or there is a Spanish rider which is not as famous as Contador was.
Maybe we'll see the first year of Enric Mas fever.
Oh, hopefully. That would be great. I mean, Enric Mas is a spectacular type of rider, you know, one that can well capture the imagination of the Spanish public, because he's a great climber and punchy. And that's basically the kind of cyclist, the kind of people that we like.
Well, we've seen how punchy you get over the issue of the Croquetas, Fran.
Yeah.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist, Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
Cuando me metí en la fuga, digo, madre mía, el panorama que me he metido, porque como se toca algo, digo, el mismo en un puerto me aprietan y me sacan de punto, pero bueno, al final no me entendió bien y...
Well, that was a very excitable Spanish voice there. That was Jorge Cubero of BH Burgos, who was in the break all day today. What was he saying, Fran? Is he similarly agitated about my mistake about croquetas?
I forgot to ask him about that, but well, no, I asked him, like, what was it like for you to be in the break with Richie Porte and Luis Ángel Maté? And he was just, you know, he had his eyes fully open. He hugged me like two or three times before and after the interview. And he was like, man, when I saw myself up there with those two excellent riders, I was afraid they were going to drop me anytime. In any small hill, I was going to get dropped. But afterwards, it went well. You know, he also told me like he had a good rapport with Porte during the breakaway. He didn't know him until today, and he seemed like a very nice guy to Cubero. And with Mate, he already know him, and the only thing that Mate asked him was to please don't contest the mountain points, because I want to get them. That's the reason why Mate was there defending his mountain jersey.
And Cubero obliged, didn't he? Because Mate took all the points, and I mean, he's been fantastic, Mate, in this first week. I think he's been on the break every road stage so far.
But yesterday he wasn't there. He decided not to contest because there weren't those many points at stake. So he said to skip the stage and take an easy day. Yeah.
But it was an interesting break, that. I mean, the Mate is actually up there racing, trying to give himself a better chance of, well, all the points he gathers now gives him a better chance of keeping the jersey into the second week, doesn't it? Which is presumably why he's doing it. Richie Porte, of course, clarified a couple of days ago that he wasn't coming to the Vuelta as an overall challenger. I know a lot of people got quite excited at the thought that Porte could win the Vuelta. Crashed out of the Tour de France, of course, had been one of the kind of second level favourites for the Tour, and so people were thinking, well, maybe he can challenge for the Vuelta. But of course, had a upset stomach on the eve of the race and was in difficulty on a couple of the days. But it was a very unusual day out for Richie Porte because of the type of rider he is, always trying to get a good GC position. He's probably never experienced being in a break on a stage as flat as that. So at the finish, I asked him how he found his day out.
It's never easy, but you know, it gives you a little bit more respect for some of those guys that target those breakaways. It's kind of fun, to be honest, I guess. Sounded pretty stressful back in the peloton, so it's just nice to be able to do something different for a change.
So Richie Porte saw a different side to cycling. A few days ago, I think he was in the Gruppetto, so that's also unfamiliar territory for him. And today he was out in the break on a flat stage, and you know, it basically made it clear that it's not a picnic out there. It's hard riding, isn't it? Especially when there's only three of you to share the work.
And with headwind, because there was headwind all over the day. You know, by what Cubero told me, Mate was the first to attack, and immediately both Porte and Cubero attacked one from each side of the peloton, and of course they gathered together, joined the forces in order to catch Mate and cooperate to establish a three-man breakaway. But yeah, I mean, it's quite unusual to see a guy with a Richie Porte's profile, with Richie Porte's pedigree, to be up there in an eventful stage.
Well, we know that sitting in the peloton, conserving a lot of energy, it's possible to almost detrain and lose condition just from sitting in the wheels and not making any effort. And if Richie Porte wants to have a good world championships, he needs to be, you know, race fresh, race fit. He needs to have some hard days. Riders sometimes say that their training days are harder than some racing days. I'm not saying it was an easy day in the bunch today, certainly a stressful day when we got into the last 30 kilometres. But he will have got a good workout riding up there with the other two today. So, well, who knows? Maybe we'll see him come into some stage-winning form by the end of the third week.
Yeah, and it would be good to see him riding a palmarès that, as far as Grand Tours are concerned, is not that big, you know. I am always surprised to see how big of a favorite he's considered in every 3-week race Richie Porte contends on. Because after all, if we consider his record, it's not that good. I mean, he has always had some problem, he has always failed, probably because he's unlucky. But when you are unlucky for, I don't know, 5-7 times, maybe there is another problem other than luck. But
I think this is an issue of nationality, isn't it, Fran? Because he's Australian, he's the big hope for an Australian podium finish in the Grand Tours at the moment. Whereas, maybe other countries have more riders that sort of share that attention. And of course, you know, the English-speaking media adopt riders from, you know, even if the outlets are British or American, they will adopt the Australian riders because I guess they think their readers and listeners are kind of a little bit more interested because they can relate, when they're on the TV, you know, they can relate immediately to them. So I think there's something in that. But it's good to see, after such a bad summer for him, prepared to get up the road and take the race on and like he said, experience something different.
Yeah, you remember the other day on one of our cultural dinners, we were speaking about Antonio Gramsci and the cultural hegemony theory that says that basically who owns the platforms owns the message, you know, and that the paradigm is set by those who write, you know. And in this case, I feel that Anglo-Saxon media has taken over the narrative of world cycling, and that's the reason why a lot of Australian, American, British rider get touted as the biggest youth talents, the most promising in the world, and later they tend to disappoint. We can think of a lot of examples, you know, with Van Garderen and Finney maybe being the paradigm, but we have also Joe Dombrowski, Nathan Haas, and the same Richie Porte. They get a lot of coverage because they are expected to do well, and there are so many English-speaking outlets that are visited everywhere in the world that they get a lot of coverage.
And do the Spanish, do our Spanish colleagues, do they kind of, you know, snigger slightly or laugh a little bit at the kind of the focus that there is on riders that perhaps don't have half the palmarès of riders, you know, some of the riders from Spain?
Not really, because after all, you know, it has taken me years to come to realize this. Of course, years of intensive coverage of cycling. Spanish-speaking media, they don't cover cycling with as much intensity as I do because they have to also work on other sports or other topics or for other clients. It's a matter of, above all, it's a matter of perception.
Very interesting, Fran. Well, we try to do our best to sort of shed light on not just the English-speaking riders, and we'll continue to do that over the rest of the Vuelta. But we'll be back tomorrow. It's another day almost like today, I guess, going back inland from where we are now, right on the eastern coast of Spain, maybe a third of the way up the country now. I'm kind of losing my bearings. I know that we're heading across towards Extremadura over the next 3 or 4 days when you leave me in the wilderness of central Spain. Tomorrow, breakaway, then a sprint.
Yeah, probably that, because Pozalcón, the final 20 kilometers can make room for some skirmishes, but I don't think they are going to be meaningful enough as to avoid a mass sprint. And by the way, we are not stepping a foot on Extremadura. I'm sorry.
So we're not setting foot. I thought we were going all the way across and just in. We're not going that far.
By what I was told by a very good friend of mine, journalist also from Extremadura, Juan Fran de la Cruz, current press officer for Polartec Comera team, one of the best cycling journalists of Spain. We are not going to enter Extremadura. The race is not going to enter Extremadura at any point, and especially me because I'm leaving. So.
Well, anyway, I will. I'll see us through to the weekend, Fran. Don't you worry. You go and enjoy your wedding party. Not your wedding party, but your friend's wedding party. But you'll be here tomorrow. So until then, thank you very much, Fran.
Thanks, Lionel.